Mr. Nader, welcome to A Closer Look. Thanks very much for giving us this time.
Thank you.
One of the things that you've talked about a lot is the ability of small organizations, small groups, to make change. But I want to explore a theory with you about whether they are enough to actually push the change past the critical point. Let's take solar power, for instance. Early on, it was small organizations, people who were dismissed originally, who got the idea of solar power into the mainstream. But now here in Georgia, one of the big utilities, Southern Company, giant also in the nuclear field, is buying up solar power capacity at a rate that would have astonished people 5 years ago. So are we at a point now where the small organizations bring things to the fore, but it takes the big structures to actually affect the change and push it past the finish line, if you will?
Well, that's happened throughout our history. It happens with small business succeeding with an innovation, and then they sell out to a larger corporation that has more capital, more marketing. That's not necessarily bad as long as the antitrust laws are enforced. So they don't buy up a lot of solar capacity in order to suppress it or price it high because they have market share control. The small groups start everything. The inventor is a small group. The people in the Declaration of Independence, small group. The women's suffrage movement, small group. And what happens is they usually succeed not only because they're persuasive, because they touch a chord of fair play, a chord of widespread support by people who are passive. They're the voters. They're the public opinion polls that get the attention of the powers that be.
So in the case of something like this, you talk a lot about corporate abuse, but are the corporations also necessary to ultimately affect change?
No, they aren't. I think that a lot of these global corporations are dysfunctional. They have no loyalty to the United States, where they were born and rose to profit on the backs of American workers or were bailed out by American taxpayers. We're dealing here with the lack of community ties by global corporations who operate in an absentee fashion, or they have franchisees that are their main street presence, but they control them through the contracts.
And part of what you're saying, I think, is that, for instance, a lot of them, while they have big operations here, operate offshore. One of the arguments about that, though, is that America has one of the highest corporate tax rates among the nations with whom we compete. So cutting the corporate tax rate, would that be one way of getting some of these companies back in the U.S. where they could then engage more?
Actually, it's a nominal tax rate that's higher, in the mid-30s percent. Mm-hmm. The real rate, because of all the deductibles, deferrals, loopholes, as they're called, is about 15%, 1.5. And that is very, shall we say, competitive with other corporations in other Western countries and Japan. In a way, there are some giant corporations in this country that pay no federal income tax in any given year. Verizon was an example of that in a couple of years, General Electric in more than a couple of years. So I'm not worried about our tax system in reality, after all the exemptions and loopholes, being a deterrence to economic activity by global corporations. As a matter of fact, the foreign giant corporations pay less taxes when they're doing business in the U.S. because of the international tax code manipulation than the domestic ones overall.
So is the solution to that changing our tax structure?
Well, I would like to change the tax structure, but not for that reason. I'd like to, first of all, tax things that society likes the least or dislikes the most. So I'd like to tax addictions more. I'd like to tax pollutions more. I'd like to tax Wall Street speculation more. That isn't taxed at all, transaction tax. I'd like to tax corporate crime more. The Canadians have a phrase that says, tax what you burn before you tax what you earn. So at the bottom should be tax on worker income, not at the first tax.
Let's pick up on at least one of those themes, and that's some of the efforts by the U.S. EPA to regulate emissions, to cut emissions from coal-fired power generating plants. Here in Georgia, that's become quite an issue because the producers and our own state regulators have said, look, we're not going to be able to achieve that. And on top of that, they say, we have already cut emissions by a tremendous amount simply by, in effect, self-regulating. Is that something that if you just allowed them to progress the way they're going, that they'd achieve it, maybe not in the time frame the feds are talking about, but you would achieve it pretty soon?
Well, not if you ask the coal industry. They're flexing their muscles, and they want to be around for the duration. And obviously, in terms of greenhouse gases, it's bad. In terms of coal miner health and safety, it's bad. In terms of ground pollution, it's bad. Coal has killed far more Americans and sickened far more Americans than all the wars combined, easily. It should be kept in the ground or used for specialty purposes, because the greatest source of energy we'll ever have, it's good for 4 billion years, is solar energy in all kinds of ways. Wind power, tidal power, photovoltaic, solar thermal, passive solar architecture. What are we waiting for? It's sort of becoming critical mass now. When it becomes more powerful, it'll be able to hold its own among the fossil fuel nuclear lobbyists.
Which brings up the question, until it does, and Georgia is one of the first states to try a new nuclear expansion, isn't nuclear a cleaner option than coal?
No, because it has a catastrophic risk of hundreds of square miles of uninhabitability if something goes wrong in terms, say, of a Class 9 meltdown. We don't know where to put the deadly radioactive waste for 250,000 years. It's a target for sabotage. It is uninsurable because the insurance companies can't assess a profitable risk. And it's unfinanceable by Wall Street without 100% taxpayer guarantee, which is the Georgia nuclear plants basically operating under a taxpayer guarantee in order to get credit from private finance. The biggest indictment of nuclear, however, is the following. If you're going to spend $12 billion or more for a nuclear plant, what if you spent it on energy conservation, solar energy? You would save far more BTUs and far more environmental damage by far than anything nuclear can contribute, even if it is economical and doesn't have an accident. So it's where you put your money. The best bang for the buck, whether it's taxpayer money or consumer money or New York finance money, is solar power.
Is there time, though, to get solar and conservation combined to a point where it would meet the demand?
Yeah, there's plenty of strong winds, South North Dakota, Montana, elsewhere offshore. It could be all done by wind power, actually, if we really had a strong national conversion policy. The sun produces infinitely more energy than we use from the sun. It's all a matter of displacing powerful vested interests who have capital in technologies now. It's not good for the health, not good for the planet, not good for consumers. And I'm talking about oil, gas, coal, and nuclear. Within 100 years, we're going to have to displace all of them with energy efficiency of monumental proportions that the technologists now can provide, as well as a variety of solar energy, including wind power.
You said efficiency would be a big part of that, but when it comes to actually putting together the conversion that you're talking about, aren't these big energy utilities the only ones that have the capital to manage that kind of conversion?
Well, if you go in terms big capital investments like solar, like 2,000 megawatts in the desert, yes, but solar comes in little gift packages as well. It comes in solar attachments to your home. Mm-hmm. It comes in solar fueled batteries, hydrogen batteries. It comes in wind power that can be very decentralized. And with a proper grid system, you could really have a more decentralized system. It's better for national security as well. I think the giant centralized utility companies are going to have to rethink their economic model, because I just think small-scale community renewable energy and efficiency is going to displace more and more of their business, as solar panels are at the present time.
And here in Georgia, the legislature just passed a bill giving individual homeowners, for instance, greater incentives to do exactly what you're talking about, install the kinds of solar systems that would work. But could everybody, even with those incentives, afford that? I mean, we're talking about underserved and poor communities, and as you know, the poverty rate is growing in this country. So would everybody be able to afford to do the kind of small-scale conversion you're talking about?
No, but not. But you see, you develop something Berkeley, California has developed, which is a credit installment system, where basically it pays for itself over a period of a few years, especially with utility rates going up higher and higher, as they have been around the country. It's just the way other consumer products were sold. They didn't expect people to buy them outright. They bought them on time. And it's something, if you're going to do any subsidies, subsidize the little guy.
And that's something you talk about in your most recent book until this one, Unstoppable. You talk about the Southern agrarian movement of the 1930s. First of all, just a little quick history of them.
Yeah, they were called the Decentralists. They were today would be called right-wingers. They so hated centralized power. Wall Street power they were against. They were against Washington power. They were even against regulatory agencies for their own benefit because they believed that they would be taken over by corporate power. And in reading the history of it for my book, Unstoppable, which basically describes the emerging left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state, I was really astonished by their sophistication. I mean, there's nothing today that has such a penetrating, relentless skepticism about concentrated power, whether it's private, corporate, or government, and what needs to replace it.
But from a practical point of view, I mean, even at the time they were around, we were much more of an agrarian society
Yes.
than we are now. Is that a sustainable model with rising populations, particularly in urban areas, and real squeezes on land and demand for mass production?
Well, it is. But on the other hand, we have new technologies that are very accessible to families and neighborhoods. Solar is one, for example. Community health clinics is two. They're now decentralized transportation modes. Certainly farmer-to-consumer markets, which are spreading in the thousands
very big here in
all
Atlanta.
Over the country. And so with the Internet also, you can use the Internet for democracy purposes, not just for video games or for Google gossip purposes.
I didn't know there were other purposes.
Yeah, I think Yes Magazine out of Seattle comes out six times a year, I think, or it chronicles community economics. I'm telling you, what's going on is in the tens of billions of dollars, and it can grow very rapidly. And every dollar you spend on a community bank or in a credit union or in a farmer's market or a community health clinic is less money you spend to make ExxonMobil or the Bank of America or Hospital Corporation of America more powerful over you.
But given our land use patterns, for instance,
yeah.
can you pull that off? I mean, we are, on the one hand, more centralized in urban areas, and yet we are more spread out in the areas outside. Certainly Atlanta is a great example of that.
Yeah, land use has been taken over by sprawl more and more, although people are surprised by how much is left over in the United States. But look what's coming. New York City rooftops now are sprouting with gardens. So they lug the soil, and they're growing more and more on their roofs. Number two, there's the vertical agriculture movement, where basically they take, say, an acre of land, and they build a skyscraper, not a skyscraper, they take an acre of land, and they build several stories of layered soil agricultural crop gardens. Now just think of the efficiency of that, and think if that spreads around the country. So you take an acre, and you basically have 6 acres. So the innovation is really quite exciting. Also, developing solar cells on the sides of large office buildings, the way Barry Commoner, the ecologist, pointed out many, many years ago. What people may not realize is that solar power was stagnant and suppressed for decades. And now it's exploding with innovation, staggering inventiveness that's occurring to the benefit of the people and the planet.
One of the people here in Atlanta who is doing that on his buildings is Ted Turner. And I think you have cited him as one of the people I can't remember the exact phrase, but enlightened rich people.
Yes.
Who could show us the way. Bill Gates is another one. But aren't those folks, wouldn't their wealth have been impossible without the kind of corporate structure that we've talked about before? And so isn't there some sort of link there? Don't we have to somehow address the larger corporate community as well?
Well, that's a good insight because unfettered capitalism produces a lot of wealth in few hands. And if the few hands are like Carnegie and he builds 2,500 libraries, it's pretty good. Or the Gates Foundation trying to save lives and infectious diseases overseas. But that's a very tiny minority. Most of the money is held by giant trusts and family names. And it is what I call dead money. It doesn't do anything, really. Live money creates things. And we've got to get multi-billionaires to move dead money more into live money, because there's a huge demand for live money, not only to reform the electoral system, but in terms of transforming our economy, democracy, technologies of people mattered, changing all the necessities that are now in such dire need, operating in decrepit institutional chains.
But is the key to doing that either some sort of structural, legislative, governmental change of our economic system, or is it through education, which is certainly what Turner, Gates, Buffett et al. Are trying to do with their friends and colleagues in the corporate community?
Well, I don't like the word education because it's too general. Okay. And civic education is what they don't talk enough about. So they want people to learn how to run computers and computer design at a young age. But I think schools should be training people, students, not just for computer skills, but for civic skills. So they learn how to navigate a democratic society, strengthen it, defend it, and produce more fruits of a democracy. We have huge poverty in this country, huge deterioration of public services. People are depressed, they're discouraged. There is no sense of posterity, the way our founding fathers used that word. And so I do make a distinction between Ted Turner and Bill Gates. I think Ted Turner is far more broad-minded. I think he has a much greater vision. I think Bill Gates is technologically restricted. He has trouble with any kind of visions. Even when he plays poker with Warren Buffett, Warren Buffett thinks that the tax system should be much more progressive, that rich people are undertaxed, and I don't think his bridge partner, Bill Gates Jr., shares that view.
There is such polarization, though, and in some of your books, it appears that you're talking across some of those divisions. But how do we get that to translate into Washington, where you get folks possibly from polar opposite sides of the spectrum, not just somewhere in between, talking to each other and being able to then convince the folks who are their base that this is a good idea?
I think that's the whole thrust of my recent book, Unstoppable. I see it everywhere. The power structure always wants to divide and rule through history, and in our country, it's divide the left from the right on areas they really disagree about and have all the focus and all the media on that, reproductive rights, school prayer, over-regulation. But if you look at the most important issues in our society, the vast majority are supported left-right. I'm talking about civil liberties. I'm talking about opposition to NSA-type surveillance. I'm talking about bloated military budgets and empire abroad. I'm talking about the use of tax dollars to wreck market discipline and bail out the Wall Street crooks or inefficient giant corporations, handouts, giveaways, subsidies, bailouts. The right calls it crony capitalism. We call it corporate welfare. Huge convergence there. There's an emerging operational convergence for prison reform and juvenile justice reform in state legislatures. Could never happen without left-right conservative liberal
lawmakers.
It's happening
lawmakers. Here in Georgia, for
there
instance.
You are. And in the book, I try to shift people's focus from the daily drumbeat of polarization, red state, blue state. You know, it's like Southerners don't bleed from pollution. They don't bleed from corporate crime. They don't bleed from consumer ripoffs. They don't bleed from occupational diseases. Nonsense. And I want to redirect the focus on 24 areas. They're in this book, Unstoppable, which are partly just public opinion convergence. They haven't gone operational. Some of them are moving operational, like restore the minimum wage. It comes in almost 80%. It's a lot of conservative voters there, including Walmart workers. Some of it is actually in the legislatures, like juvenile justice. And I've seen in the last 30, 40 years, just in Congress, the Free Information Act was left-right. Mm-hmm. Auto Safety Bill was left-right, 1966. The False Claims Act, allowing people to sue companies to defraud the taxpayer, that was left-right. It was Chuck Grassley, Republican senator from Iowa, with Howard Berman, Democrat from California. Just recently, the Whistleblower Protection Act, up against powerful corporate lobbies, as all these other acts were. The corporate lobbies lost.
Aren't some of the issues, though, very complicated depending on how you look at them? For instance, you mentioned NSA-type surveillance.
Yeah.
If you ask people, do you want the NSA looking at some of your private activities, everybody's going to say no. If you say, do you want greater surveillance of terror suspects,
yeah,
everybody's going to say yes. So is there a way to have it both ways?
Yes. So as you know, public opinion polls are largely how you phrase the question.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say, do you want surveillance over suspected terrorists in the mode where they spy on all your telephone calls and all your emails 100% of the time, 100% of the American people? I don't think people would say yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do they want a sensitive conversation between a patient and his or her doctor to be scooped up by the NSA for possible future use? No, I really have been around the country so many times and for so many years that I notice the divide and rule tactic. It works. It does work. It works less at some local levels where they all want their roads repaired and they're willing to pay for it, or they want safe food for their kids or non-harmful medicines. The more empirical you get, the more you get into the experience where people live, work, and raise their children, the less ideological you get. And I think that's the political realignment of the next 12 years. I don't see the two major parties or any other electoral institution up against a two-party tyranny like third parties being able to politically realign the way a left-right alliance in state legislatures, municipal councils, and the Congress can do so, and can do so rapidly.
So you're saying this has to happen not in Washington, but in the state capitals.
And in Washington as well, where state capitals don't have the overall jurisdiction. I mean, you could do good energy policy at state capitals. If you're going to have a national conversion, you need Congress.
Does that mean then that you would rule out another run for the White House?
I'm not running anymore uphill in a rigged system where most people don't even know I'm running because of the media blackout and exclusion from the debates, even though poll after poll wanted me on the debates, maybe just to reduce the level of boredom on the audience.
You've been at this for so long. One of the questions, if you look back from the Unsafe at Any Speed, the Corvair investigation that really brought you into national prominence, do you drive a car now, number one? And number two, if you do, what kind of car do you drive?
I have a license, but I don't own a car. And the reason why was many years ago, I was concerned that a car company would ballyhoo it and prejudice my arm's length relationship trying to get all cars to be safer in crashes and safer to operate. It does restrict your personal flexibility. You don't have much privacy. But you know, I am very pleased. I lived in a country that gave me an opportunity to really make some fundamental changes. I'm sorry to say that this is the 50th year of Unsafe at Any Speed's publication, and I don't think a book can change things anymore the way Silent Spring, The Other America by Michael Harrington, or Unsafe at Any Speed. We're living in a heavily illiterate society where the younger generation is consumed by these iPhone and other gadgets.
But doesn't that give the opportunity for say, if Michael Harrington were around today, wouldn't he put The Other America out, let's say, on a podcast or on some sort of digital media in addition to that, with pictures and video and so forth?
No doubt.
I mean, aren't the platforms still there?
Platforms are enormous. They're widespread. The problem is with the readers, listeners, viewers. They're either overloaded or they're distracted by 24/7 entertainment and limitless gossip between them and their friends via the smartphone.
So to come back to where we started then, does that make it tougher for those small groups to penetrate? Small groups that we talked about that were change agents, does it make it harder for them to penetrate what you just talked about and actually affect change?
In some areas it does, like it certainly does in tax reform or electoral reform or third parties. In the area of local food, however, and local community health clinics and local credit, I think it makes it even easier.
So you don't have a vintage Corvair in the garage somewhere?
Actually, I do.
You do? Okay.
Yes. We're opening the first law museum in America in the fall in Connecticut, and it's called the American Museum of Tort Law, and I have an old Corvair that's going to be polished up to be placed in the museum.
You're not going to take it for a spin?
It's too decrepit to take for a spin.
Ralph Nader's latest book is Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President. His earlier, most recent book before that is Unstoppable. Mr. Nader, thanks so much for giving us this time. We really
thank you very much, Dennis.
It.